Hello, welcome to the Harvard EdCast, a series of conversations with thought leaders in the field of education from across the country and around the world. I'm your host, Jill Anderson, filling in for Matt Weber. Today, we are speaking with Ron Suskind, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and father. Among the many things we could discuss with Ron, and there are many, we'll be talking about that last one, being a father, particularly a father to his son, Owen, who was diagnosed 23 years ago with regressive autism. Their discovery of how Disney movies helped open communication inspired the book and Oscar-nominated film Life Animated. Welcome to the EdCast, Ron.
Great to be here. I love the Ed School.
We like to hear that. You've been very busy over the past few months, to say the least, with the film and Autism Awareness Month.
Yeah.
How's that been for you?
Well, it's been a kind of a wave that we've been riding that just hit the beach gloriously over the past month. I wrote this book, Life Animated, A Story of Psychics, Here's an Autism, in 2014, in the spring it came out. And it really started a wave. I've been involved in this sort of global news cycle stuff for years because I've written books about presidents, and of course those roil the global cycles with great vigor. But this wave was different. It was large, and it was warm, and it was powerfully inclusive. And at the core of it, it's about seeing folks who we often discard as not them but us. And that's part of the struggle that is reflected in both the book and in the movie that was nominated for an Academy Award. The movie we started to film just prior to the book's release. And so it was a year plus of filming of the whole family. Owen, my son, who's now just turned 26, is the main character. But his sidekicks, so to speak, are Cornelia's mom and me, his dad, and his older brother, Walter. And he is now a global character, a character that has, by showing the nature of his yearning, his life, his aspirations, and his capacities, has helped people see that the word disability, though important as terminology, also has a twin of differently abled as opposed to just disabled. And also what Owen often says is a different, not less. And that's a powerful expression of a kind of social change, and I think even social justice. For one out of four people now are considered neurodiverse or neurodivergent, between autism and ADHD and OCD and dyslexia and all sorts of other things that seem to be widely arrayed in the population.
You know, you've touched maybe a little bit upon this just now in your answer, but you moved away through the book and even the movie in some ways from being a parent advocate for your son to kind of an advocate for all parents of children with autism. And what has that experience been like for you?
Well, I think what was interesting is that the book kind of revealed us all. I've been in education circles, certainly, and in, the debate on national affairs since my first book, A Hope in the Unseen, came out in 1998. Now, as some people might recall, that's where I followed an inner-city African-American kid from a blighted urban school in Washington, D.C., to Brown University. The series in the Wall Street Journal won the Pulitzer in 1995, and then the book came out in 1998 after I followed him through his first year at Brown. And that was about a person who'd been discarded by society's norms, by decisions often made without him being present as to his capability, as to the potential in his life. His dad was in jail most of his life. His mom was on welfare. And what I realized is that what was driving that book and my search across 20 years for people discarded around the world, in Pakistan and Afghanistan and the hollows of America and poverty, was that the most dramatically discarded person was living in our bedroom, our son, who was deemed uneducable, probably slated for an institution up ahead. And Owen and all those characters worked in a kind of symbiosis So when we did the book, Life Animated, and then the movie, it in a way kind of outed us to say, you know, well, I'm not just here writing the stories anymore that might help you arrive at a place of clarity or maybe a purse of social action, a place of social action. This is our life, and this is who we are. And that led quickly to us being more than just observers, but more and more advocates to say, we have over a long life of search arrived at answers, answers that demand remedies and outcomes. And that's been the big change. And it's a interesting new place for the whole family to be, certainly for me to be.
Yeah, I would think as a journalist, it's definitely an interesting place to be.
You know, in some ways, I think a lot of journalists have a lot of very strong feelings about, you know, especially the ones who have spent some time doing the real deep digging on the reporting, to say there is kind of a right answer to some of these things. It's not simply sort of he said, she said, you know, or one side says this and another side contradicts them. Over time, it becomes more difficult as the reporting grows and accretes to just say, and all sides are equal in their perspective, when the facts don't comport with that. And that's kind of where we've ended up here.
So how has your life changed in the sense of how often do you hear from parents? Is this a weekly, daily, hourly thing?
That daily to hourly. I mean, I speak now. I do the commencements and things like that. But I speak in front of large groups of parents, as does my family from time to time. And in a way, you know, I stand there as a mirror to them and their life, but also as somebody who has access to those who make decisions. You know, I've interviewed presidents, and my books are the ones that many of the historians use, you know, for the Clinton era, the Bush era, the Obama era. You know, and those books certainly are about what government is able to do, maybe what they intend versus how it turns out, why, in so many cases, high ideals do not yield action and outcome for people, especially people looking, as all people do, to government for redress of grievance. And now they call me, and they also, interestingly, many of the parents also say, you know, thank you for affirming what we thought we were seeing too in our neurodiverse child, many of these kids autistic or adults, that, you know, he or she has a passion. It's often a singular deep passion. That's part of the so-called phenotype of autism. You know, social-emotional difficulties because they can't read social cues, repetitive activity, and passionate, narrow interests. And those interests were often seen over the last X number of decades as obsessions because they don't fit quite the way we who are so-called neurotypical do it, where we move around more like, you know, bees to flowers. But we began to realize that, you know, folks on the spectrum are just extreme versions of the rest of us. We may have many passions. They tend to have one or a few. They go 1,000 feet deep on the thing they love, and they turn it into a map, a mirror, a code breaker with their emotions, their place in the world, often quite ingeniously. And that's not a deficit. That's a strength. And that's the great aha of our journey. That is spreading widely, not just to folks with autism, but people more broadly in many areas of education, lots of disciplines, and just the way people are living their life nowadays. I mean, remember, we're living in a very different time than when I was a kid. You've got on that phone in your hand, you've got the Library of Alexandria times 10,000. It's right there. We're in a Gutenberg moment right now. What's happening is when kids are littler and littler, they're beginning to self-nourish based on the stuff that they love, that really drives them, lifts them, incenses them, taps their intrinsic motivation. And that's the way learning happens best, the way growth occurs, Now they can feed it. It's disrupting education. It's disrupting therapy. It's disrupting many ways in which the world works. And folks who are autistic, well, they're just very focused, very intense versions of the rest of us in this particular way. And that's a beautiful connective insight, I suppose. So lots of parents are saying, okay, I get it now. Yeah. My kid's a Harry Potter kid. My kid's a Star Wars kid. They call all the time. Hey, my kid's black and white movies from the 1940s and 50s. I'm like, great. Preston Sturges, gotta love it. You know, mine's astrophysics, fabulous. And what I say to them, which is something educators, the best ones I think, say, is that, you know, that high school poem by William Blake, The World in a Grain of Sand, Eternity in an Hour, he's right. If you know how to look. The DNA of all things is findable in almost everything if you know how to look. And that's what we learned. That's the way the world works. And so that's the very heartening reversal of the telescope and turn in understanding that we're right at the center of. So we that's part of what the parents and I talk about every day.
When you're talking about this reversal of the telescope, do you ever find yourself looking back to when Owen was first diagnosed and wishing that you'd done something differently?
Oh, all the time. I mean, you know, we know we knew what we knew year to year as the years passed. You know, in a way, we're in a 23-year experiment of search and find, fall down, dust yourself off, and get up, and living very, very much in the present tense where Owen was living. He lives more in the present tense than the rest of us. You know, just like the Dalai Lama and all those yogis recommend in their meditations. And part of it is we were so fearful of even thinking about what the future held for him. But yeah, I mean, you know, we ended up because we were, you know, we were a mess is what we were. We were humbled. What you find is what the philosophers tell you, humility is the seedbed of learning and of growth. And we were humbled by this. You know, I used to think, oh, you know, I've got two sons, Walter, his older brother, and Owen. So that means, you know, well, they'll both be presidents after they win their Nobel Prizes. And, of course, the Olympic medals will be earlier. And I'm like, wait a minute. Well, how much of that do most parents carry around? You know, what's the usual allotment? Well, I could tell you exactly, because when Owen was diagnosed, I had to tear every one of those out of my being in regard to Owen and smash them in the corner. The pile's quite high. It was quite liberating, in fact, now that I look back. You know, Owen changed when the autism hits him just shy of his third birthday, and he loses all speech, and our life is turned upside down. But the book and the movie is as much about how we changed. Mm-hmm. And those changes we all see as changes of value, many of them against our will, of course, but ones that help actually make our lives fuller, richer, made me a better journalist.
To the parent maybe out there who's listening and their child is newly diagnosed with autism, what would you say to them?
Well, I'd say, don't let fear overcome you.
Mm-hmm.
Think clearly about these expectations you had for your child. What is their origin? Where do they come from, these things that you hope for, or expect, dream about? Are they more about you, more about them? Assume competency, even if your child has no speech. What we find for the kids who eventually emerge and are able to communicate, maybe with augmentative devices, some of them, because about a third of kids on the spectrum can't speak, is that they are in there, and they're noticing everything. And their memories are better than ours. The other thing I'll say to you, say to the parents, is that my friends, the neuroscientists, and these days we have a lot of them, we're kind of a neuroscience fantasy camp, we can call them on the phone. They say, you know, this neuroplasticity, the plasticity of the brain, which is really only a few decades along in terms of our understanding, you know, it's very disruptive, but also illuminating. What it means is that the brain is incredibly nimble. growing cells all the time, cutting new neural pathways, often because of challenges the brain faces, even injuries. And that for every area of deficit, the brain finds a way by carving somewhere an equal and opposite strength. It's not if, but where. Find it and feed it. Now, Owen, with his challenges because of the autism, of course, he has deep deficits. He will his whole life. But he does several things 4 and 5 times better than I do. And I teach at Harvard Law School. That's important to remember. Look for the compensatory strengths, even in areas that are not easily validated. Their pattern recognition will be higher than yours. Their memory, much higher. Their visual acuity, way beyond you. They will remember things in pictures, in snapshots of the world. Be able to go back and examine them over and over again. And think about it, pattern recognition. What is intelligence other than that? You know, at the end of the movie, Owen speaks to an international delegation of specialists, autistic spectrum researchers and autism clinicians from around the world in France. At the end, he says, I'm a proud autistic man. Right there, a proud autistic man, ready for a future that is bright and full of wonder.
Talking about futures that are bright, my last question for you is about education and autism and what you'd really like to see happening in education and how educators can move forward in this area.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I've been writing about education for almost 3 decades at this point. And I wrote in earlier days about kids who were denied a life of possibility because of bad luck of birth. African-American, Latino-American, folks, often poor white folks from impoverished parts of America. And how the one-size-fits-all yardsticks that education necessarily embrace, because, look, you got to measure something, even if those yardsticks are not perfect. How those yardsticks often ended up excluding rather than including people in all the ways they're diverse and all the ways we express intelligence. What I tell educators is don't be too sure of your ability to measure something as ethereal as aptitude, as creativity, as self-knowledge born of survival, or of ingenuity. Look, it's going to be 1,000 years before we can measure that stuff. It's like catching sunlight in mason jars. You know, and I think that's important for educators to remember, is that those yardsticks that often have enormous transactional outcomes attached to them are really human inventions. And giving them up or seeing them in that way allows an educator to see many things that they might have either been taught or otherwise inclined and impelled to miss. Those compensatory strengths, the kids that don't fit, the folks who can't hit the bell, you know, as compared to so many kids who learn the game. Give the teacher what they want on a silver platter with a garnish, and get your ticket punched for the next round of musical chairs, and up you go. And mom is very proud. You know, lots of folks can't do that. And that's not necessarily a deficit. It's just the way they are. I think that's what we're finding with education, is that it's, in a way, much more complex, but at its core, much simpler than we often thought. Find their passion, help them turn it into a pathway, feed into it the basics of how we learn and what we need to learn. And the individual, the kid, ends up doing a lot of your work for you. And that's a nice lesson. Doesn't make teachers any less. It helps them to be more in the role of midwives, birthing the potential that's out there. And it's fast.
Well, thank you, Ron, so much. That's a very powerful message, I think, for all parents and educators, not just those who are dealing with either children who have autism or on the neurodiverse spectrum, as you called it. Really inspirational.
Well, you know, you all do at Harvard Education and all the big education schools, you know, as I said, word replacement therapy, survival, and hope. Keep it up.
All right. Great. Thank you again. And for people who want to follow you, they can check out your website. Where is that?
Yeah, they can go to ronsuskind.com. They can go to lifeanimated.com. And actually, they can go to something new called sidekicks.com, where we've built, with a team of neuroscientists and leading technologists, a new set, a new generation, really, of augmentative, supportive, and really fun devices that educators are crowding in to use. And you can see that on sidekicks.com. It's a way just to tap that passion and turn it into a pathway, no matter what the kid loves. And it's quite something.
So check that out, everybody. Sidekicks.com, you said?
Yeah, sidekicks.com. You'll see it right there. You can download now, and you can go in the App Store and download sidekicks.com. It's called Sidekicks for Autism, but frankly, it's for everyone.
Yeah, this is great. This has been the Harvard EdCast, a production of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I'm your host, Jill Anderson. Thank you very much for listening.